everybody. I'm Sandra, and I'm a drug addict.
Hi, Sandra.
My voice sounds really tiny, but anyway. Yeah, I'd like to thank the committee and all the people that make this meeting possible, because I do think it's a great meeting. It has a strong message of recovery, and that's exactly what I needed when I first came, when I was a newcomer. And I'd also like to say that it's a great privilege to be able to share my experience, strength, and hope with you. And it's also an incredible privilege to be, you know, the person who has survived being addicted to drugs. You know, there's a reading that we do at the beginning, and it says, remember, we didn't become addicted in one day, so easy does it. And I always think, who wrote that? Because I think I did become addicted in one day. The first time I ever did drugs, I absolutely loved it. You know, and my first thought when I got stoned was, there is now no doubt in my mind that God exists. And the first drug that I ever did, right, was alcohol. But when I... You know, I loved smoking cannabis. That was my drug of choice, and I rarely had a choice. But when I first smoked that, that's when I was like, oh my God, this is great. Finally, I could be in the world, in my body and in my mind and in the world. Whereas formerly, all of these things were in massive conflict with each other. You know, and I used from the age of 15 until the age of 25. And some might say that's not a long time to use. But 10 years of, you know, that kind of... We talk a lot about the external impact of being a drug addict in the rooms of NA and what that looks like. But I like to talk also about what happened on the inside and what that felt like. And, you know, when I first started at 15, you know, I was a young woman. I was trying to figure out how to live in the world. And when I found drugs, I had found the solution to my problems at that time, and I wore out that solution pretty quick. And like I say, for me, I do believe I became addicted in one day, but the message is still, I need to, you know, easy does it is still a message I need to hear. Yeah, they just brought so much peace and comfort into my life. But pretty soon they started to govern every single aspect of my life. You know, I managed the external things really well. You know, I had gone to university, and I had, by the time I came into the program, I had 2 degrees. I had a regular degree, and I had a graduate degree. And these things were perfect excuses for convincing myself that I didn't have a problem. And wow, I didn't realize how hard this would be. You know, I lived this for 10 years, and to explain it in 40 minutes is kind of a lot. And also, I don't like to talk a lot about the war stories. I really like what it says in the book. You know, a lot has been written about addiction, but there's very little written about recovery, and that's what the book is devoted to. Before I found NA and AA, I thought, because my drug of choice was cannabis, I thought I was fine. I had been telling myself that in order to qualify as a drug addict, you had to be doing a lot of crack and heroin. And that is certainly the case, I'm sure. But for me, to qualify as a drug addict, the level of personal shame I had was enough to qualify me as a drug addict. And the insanity that the addiction brought me to. I hear people share about like having relationships and living with their parents and stealing off them and all this stuff. My disease completely isolated me. I had almost no contact with the outside world. I could go days and weeks without speaking to other people. Often my only contacts were with my drug dealers. It became gradually more and more isolated, and I guess because of the drug that I used, I became profoundly mentally ill. I guess you could say I was almost in a constant state of mental breakdown from about the age of 20, 21 to 25. I had been institutionalized several times, mental institutions. And I didn't go to prison, which is pretty cool because at the end I was quite homicidal. there was lots of potential there. I guess it was good that I was in the mental institutions. But like I say, early on I was quite suicidal, but then at the end I became homicidal. I had a lot of pent-up anger inside of me, and I used drugs to press that down. At the end of my using, on the outside, this is what it was like. I weighed about maybe 5 stone, I think maybe 70 pounds. I had no hair. My haircut was the number 2 on the razor. And people thought I was a boy. And I liked that because I was terrified of being in the world. And for me, that outside stuff, it kind of gives you a picture of what was going on the inside, which is that I was in agony. I had a good friend, and he said to me, "Sandra, do you know why it is that you smoke drugs so much?" And I said, "Yeah, of course I do. It's 'cause they make me feel good." And he said, "Well, why is it that you can't feel good without them?" And it was kind of one of those questions that kind of cut right down deep inside me, so I couldn't even look at him to answer the question, because I knew that I was incapable of feeling good on my own. And I guess I feel really sad when I think about those 10 years when I was using, because that woman had absolutely no idea how to live. And you guys have a saying here, you say the world owed me a living. And that's the way I thought. It wasn't true, but I had a lot of things in my head that weren't true that I thought were true. And I was a thief as well, not to my family, but to other people. I thought that was being moral. I wouldn't steal from people I knew. I would steal from, like, businesses and things like that. At the very end, like I say, I didn't have any, I didn't have anybody in my life. I was living in a flat that had, all the food I had left. Like I say, I was like 70, 75 pounds, so I clearly wasn't eating. And the food in my cupboards had rotted so bad that there were maggots crawling up and down the walls. And I didn't even notice. And it took me 2 years in recovery before I realized that it wasn't a particularly hot summer that year, which had made the maggots grow on my walls. It took me 2 years into recovery before I realized it was because I let the food rot. And I grew my own maggots in my cupboards because I was so busy smoking dope on my couch. I never left my fucking couch. I remember thinking how sad it was that I never did anything else with my hands except roll joints. My hands did nothing else. And it stopped working. I wore out the solution. and that was a desperate situation. I went to a treatment center. It was in Toronto, in Canada. I went to this treatment center, and they said, okay, you're a drug addict. You can't use drugs. This is how you feel before you use them. This is how you feel when you use them. This is how you feel after. You get the idea. Don't use them. I was like, okay. And that was all right. And then they didn't say anything about drinking. And so I drank a lot after I got out of the treatment center. And, you know, I always drank to oblivion, and that was always kind of where I wanted to get with when I was using drugs as well, was to a state of complete oblivion. But eventually they didn't kind of address kind of the way, you know, the drug that I like to take addressed that, what they call like that God-shaped hole, you know, like. So I called up a friend of mine and I said, listen, Brian, I want to get high again. Do you have any? Let's get together. And he's like, right on, you're back. And I was back, you know, like we got together, we were at this party there was, you know, just a cannabis joint going around the room, and I took a toke off it and everything changed. And for me, you know, there's not a doubt in my mind that I'm a drug addict. Like, if I can get as insanely addicted to cannabis as I was, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind. I took a toke off that joint and everything fucking changed, you know, and I was staring at that thing going around the room and everyone was taking way too long to fucking smoke it. And, you know, I was too embarrassed in front of everybody to go digging in that ashtray for the roach. So I waited till everyone left and I dug in that ashtray for a roach like a fucking lunatic, like a fucking loser, right? But, like, I wasn't a lunatic and I wasn't a loser. I was just, like, profoundly addicted to drugs. And I thought that night, like, I thought I'd be able to take care of it, and I thought I'd be able to manage it, and I so was not able to manage it. I came home that night and I said to myself, okay, we're gonna get up tomorrow and we're not gonna smoke. And I knew I was gonna get up tomorrow and I was gonna smoke, and I was like, no, we're not gonna. So, you know, I went to bed and I laid down in bed and I thought, oh God, what was I doing trying to get clean? This is so great. I feel so good. And then I woke up the next day, and that day of, I'm not gonna use today, those two armies that were warring inside my head, they warred inside my head for like another 6 months every day. I said, I'm not gonna use. And at the end of that, I had reached kind of new depths of agony and self-hate that I haven't known of since. And, you know, for me, one of the things that I'll never forget about the days when I was using is how, you know, with no one around and only myself in a room, I'd be ashamed of myself to myself. And if you know what that feels like, then you're probably in the right place. And I called up this friend of mine who asked me, you know, why don't you feel good? And because he'd been in AA and he'd been in NA, and I told him, like, I was desperate, I couldn't stop, I didn't know what to do, and he brought me to a meeting, and I kind of thought that was it, you know, that you come into the meetings and then that's it. But of the time that I've been around, I've noticed that there's a few critical junctures in which it's possible for a drug addict to slip. And coming into the rooms is one of them, you know, because it's a terrifying thing to do. And I think it's really important to reach out to newcomers and to be friendly. I really, people were so friendly to me when I first came in, and that was so hugely important for me. And I tried to do that today. I tried to be friendly to people. including people who've been around a long time, rather than waiting for people to be friendly to me, you know? So I was at this critical juncture. I had 1 month clean and sober, and I thought that all I have to do is stay in the rooms to stay sober and to stay clean. And my situation in Canada was a bit crazy, and I did something a bit more crazy. I moved to East Asia, and I fell through that critical juncture, you know, where. You know, where it's really important if you're new to keep going to meetings on a regular basis so that people get to know you, so you can welcome people into your life. And I didn't check out about meetings when I went, and I just thought I'd be fine. But I'm really grateful that I didn't use. And there's a couple of things that have happened to me in my recovery that kind of indicate to me that were I to use again, I'm pretty sure that that I wouldn't ever make it back. Anyway, I was in Seoul in South Korea, and there was this woman I met, and we were at a bar together, and we were both drinking Coca-Cola, and she said, "Why don't you drink?" And I said, "I don't know. I don't drink." She said, "Are you a friend of Bill W.'s?" I said, "Yeah." And I was so happy, and she had 11 years, and she hadn't been to a meeting in ages. She said, "How long has it been since you used or had a drink?" I said, "A month and a half." She's like, "Shit, dude, you gotta get to a meeting." I was like, yeah, I guess maybe. Do they have any? And then she brought me. And then I entered this other critical stage, which is I was going to the meetings, and I wasn't... I didn't have a sponsor, and I wasn't doing the steps, and I kind of approached recovery the way I approached everything else in my life, which is to sit in the back, do as little work as possible, and do as little work as possible. That's pretty key for me, and try to get by in that way. And I was like that for 7 months, and I was going completely insane. And there was this incredible woman in the rooms over there, and she called me up one day. She needed a favor for something, and I helped her out. And then on the phone, she started asking me, like, "So since you've been in the rooms, you know, what has changed for you?" And I told her, like, I have a nice place to live, and I have some money, and I don't have maggots climbing up and down my walls. And I have food in the cupboard, and I'm no longer 70 pounds. You know, like I have hair. And then she asked about the internal stuff. She said, "Well, but how do you feel about yourself?" And I would encourage you to ask yourself that question. How do you feel about yourself? Because that was the main reason why I used drugs in the first place. I never used drugs because of external stuff. I always used them because of internal stuff. And that hadn't changed, so she kind of got my attention, you know? And I had this voice in my head that used to tell me that I was a piece of shit, and that I wasn't worth the breath in my lungs, you know? That wasn't worth anything. And that voice used to wake me up in the morning, and it used to stay with me all day until I got high. And then sometimes it would come back, and I'd have to get high again. And that voice was still there, even though I was clean, and that was a pretty terrifying place to be. Anyway, this woman, she said, "You know, if you don't work the steps, you're going to relapse." And that kind of got my attention too. But I was scared, and I said to her, "But you don't even know me. How dare you say that? You don't even know me." And she said, "If you're a drug addict, I know everything I need to know about you." And she was right. And so, you know, I asked this woman, I said, well, then fine, would you be my sponsor? Would you take me through the steps? And she was a soldier from America, and she was going to Iraq, and she couldn't. And like I said, I was in East Asia. There were very few women there to sponsor. I mean, there were women, like, but not women in expat AA there. And there was this guy who had amazing recovery who was, he was my age at that time. He was 26. I had just turned 26. And he had something like 8 or 9 years. And he had incredible recovery. And I asked him to be my sponsor. And I mean, he was straight, you know, he was beautiful. He had his life together. And I didn't ask him because he was beautiful or because he was straight. I asked him because I was desperate and there was nobody else. And he asked his sponsor and he came back to me and he said yes because he knew it was a desperate situation. And I'm really grateful for that. You know, he didn't see a woman addict. He just saw an addict. And like it says, principles before personalities. And I believe, you know, if we're spiritually fit, we can take anyone through these steps, so long as the sponsee is willing to go through the steps. And that man saved my life, and I'm indebted to him to this day. You know, I had been in the rooms for a while, so I had done step one and two. You know, I knew that I was powerless over drugs, that my life was unmanageable. And I had given myself over to the rooms as a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity. I tripped up on the God thing, though. And the problem was that, you'll remember I said when I first started smoking dope, I thought, yeah, God exists. So when I stopped smoking, it was like a grief. There was this great grief. I had to kind of grieve the loss of this God that I had found, and which had stopped working. And the other reason why I had a problem with God is, you know, when I was growing up, there was a lot of crazy things happening in my house that ought never happen in any house. And I used to go to bed, you know, when I was 5, and I used to pray, God, if you exist, kill me in my sleep. And those were prayers of faith. And they clearly were not answered. And so I thought, well, you mustn't exist. But it's a terrible thing for me to challenge God, because I had faith. So it was all, I was terrified when I began those prayers, and later I was cocksure when I said them. So I had convinced myself that that God couldn't possibly have existed because of things that were going on around me. And if you're familiar with the literature, you'll be aware that there's something which says, what separates the men from the boys? Boys pray for self-directed objectives. I was 5 and I was praying for self-directed objectives. Men pray for God's perfect objectives. And I couldn't have been a woman at age 5. You know, those are okay prayers for a 5-year-old. They're not okay prayers for a 25-year-old. And my higher power, my sponsor said to me, you know, just don't worry about the God thing, just get down on your knees and pray. And the whole thing, get down on your knees, it just had this weird sexual innuendo that I hated, and yeah, and I didn't think it was funny, incidentally, but I did it because I was so terrified of using drugs again. And I think that carrying on with the steps is an indication of completely taking step one. You know, like I so knew that I was powerless over drugs. I was willing to do anything. And I remember I closed the curtains to my flat and I made sure the door was locked. And I got down on my knees and I prayed. And I had the strange sensation that someone was watching me. And it's because I know now that I was being watched and I was not by myself. And that I was finally meeting my maker and asking for help, like I had never asked for help before. And if you haven't tried it, like I say, I had tried it at 5, yeah? But if you haven't tried it in a while, I would encourage you to give it a try, because it actually works. And so I would do that every day. I would pray. And because my faith was not strong, I asked for my faith to be made strong. And because I was an impatient lunatic, I prayed for patience and sanity. And those things were granted to me. And I did my step 3 with my sponsor. And I felt a change immediately. And the step 3 prayer, I think, is a beautiful one. And then I did my step 4, and I, like a lot of people, I took a lot of time putzing about. Step 4 actually doesn't take that long. If you sit down, put the pencil in your hand, drag it across the paper, yeah? Probably only takes a couple hours. Some people die right in step 4. Some people relapse right in step 4. And that step's probably... I don't know if you could say that step hasn't killed a lot of drug addicts. But it certainly turned a lot of them away from working the rest of the steps. I'm really grateful it didn't do that for me. You know, self-examination is thoroughly a part of my life today. I wouldn't be without it. Of course, at the top of the list was mother, and under that was father. And pretty much every 5th step I've ever heard takes that same order. And I remember I told my sponsor, I said, I resent my mother. What's the cause? Well, she let my father beat the fucking shit out of me. What does it affect? Everything. What's my part? Well, now I resented that box. But I didn't have a part at the time. Although now I've realized that part of me as a child did like the attention, because it was the only attention I got. But that's hardly a part. But as an adult, you know, I need to let go of that stuff. And I know when I meet my maker, it's one of the first questions I'm gonna ask. But it won't come from a place of anger when I ask. And like I say, underneath that was my dad, and my resentment was because he beat the shit out of me. And it affected everything, and what was my part, you know, like I kind of showed up for it. And I needed to let that go. But this was the turning point for me, because if my sponsor had said to me, you know, you gotta go back to your parents and fuse your life together with them and be a happy family, I would have said, go fuck yourself. Goodbye. You know, so I'm really grateful that he never said that. And the time is really running and I want to get through all of them, so I'll just, the rest of my resentments were petty. You know, I resented people because they were successful at things I wanted to be successful at. I resented people because they were able to work for things and carry out and achieve things that I wanted to, without having to, of course, put in any of the work. But at the bottom of it and at the end of it all, I had all of those 7 deadly sins and pride. And I was able to count them up after, and I figured out that pride and envy and greed were the main ones for me. And, you know, when I shared that 5th step with my sponsor, I felt like it says in the literature, true kinship with my fellow human being. And I did feel that there was something changed. And I knew that I would never use drugs again. It says, like, step 4 is about the things which caused us to use and the conditions under which we used. So I had set those through the inventory, and I had seen what they were. And I was able to see them again when I encountered them after step five. You know that part where it says what separates a man from a boy, and it comes in his prayers. It talks about that in the essay to step six in the 12 and 12, which is part of AA, but whatever. Everything's useful. You know, and so I was able to build further my relationship with God and ask for those things to be taken away. And they weren't all taken away. And I've discovered new character defects in recovery, which has been scary. And you know, I was a bit scared about the amends part because, like I say, I had been a thief. And I had thought the world owed me a living. And I had a lot of financial amends to make, and I went back to Canada, and I went into this, you know, got all the places I'd stolen from, and I learned during the process of that step that there are plenty of people who have far greater, far more beautiful and far more sophisticated spirituality than I had ever imagined. You know, like I went into these shops where I'd stolen from, and this one guy, kind of, he was at the till, and he said, "Listen, I need to talk to you, and come here." And he kind of was weird, and kind of we went over the corner, and he said, "Listen, I used to live here a couple of years ago. I used to come in here, and I used to take stuff without paying for it, and I want to pay for it now." And he said, "You know, you're welcome back here anytime." And I had gone in there thinking that that place owed me, you know, and this guy, and this kind of thing happened time and time again. And I was able also during that process of amends to meet up with my mother and father again, who I hadn't seen for a long time. And I was able to meet up with them like as a woman, as a grown woman, instead of as a child. And I have good firm boundaries with my parents today. Which is something that recovery and outside stuff has taught me. And I think it's probably coming to the end of the time, but thanks. You know, the rest of the steps, 10, 11, and 12, I mean, they're fantastic for keeping us away from going back. You know, because I know it's perfectly possible for me to go back to using drugs. And I still have no doubt that I'm a drug addict. And although I struggle sometimes to remember what it was like, because my life in no way resembles what it did when I first came in here. And I know that I totally don't even resemble what I was like when I first came in here. And I've achieved so much. A lot of things I've worked for and I've achieved them, and other things have been granted to me and given to me. I want to say something about my relationship with God, and if you don't like that word, that's okay. You can just bleep it out. You know, it's the most important relationship I have in my life today. And when we do step one, you know, it's such a lonely and depressed place. And step two is like an introduction. It's like saying to you, you can have a friend. And originally, or initially, the friend is the rooms. But later on, it's something far greater than that. And like I say, my relationship with God is the most important relationship I have in my life today. And I don't pray to my higher power to bring me a lover, or to bring me friends, or to bring me money. Well, if I pray for things like that, I'm usually in a dark place. And I always add, if thy will be done, which is the get out clause. And, yeah, and you know, the other thing which is really important for me to stay clean is working with other drug addicts. And there's no way I'd be without that. And I think that's the point when we step from bridge to shore. that's the point where it really starts to happen. Because I've met some incredible people in the rooms who are drug addicts, and I've seen them transformed into incredibly beautiful women who are capable and strong and have a good relationship with God. And it's wonderful that that their higher power is able to work through me and to do that for them. And you know, I really love NA, and I want to be a little old lady coming into the rooms of NA. And because I think it's really cool to be an old timer, and I also think it's really cool to know the literature and to have worked the program and to talk a bit of sense when it comes to recovery. I think we have a responsibility to each other, you know, because I wouldn't be here without you guys, and I think maybe I help you a little too. So thanks for listening to me.